drown. And we've seen it time and time again in today's society. Children who start doubting everything or start questioning everything and even lose their faith. Why? Because they came across somebody, they came across a mentor or a friend that was questioning a lot of things, that put doubts in their mind, and they didn't have the ability to counter them. They didn't have the ability to, they weren't equipped with the tools to be able to answer these questions.
Right. So this in itself, this in itself shows the importance of how important it is to grow in knowledge in your children, to so that they can answer these doubts and so that they can, you know, be strong and firm in their faith. Well, brother, we'll discuss more with you. We would love to hear more from you after a short break. The listeners, stay tuned.
The Prophet sallallahu alayhi wa alihi wa sallam said, "He who recites the Quran before puberty has indeed been given wisdom in his childhood."
Welcome back, the esteemed audience of IRIB English Radio. You're listening to Islamic Upbringing, and we are with Brother Miqdad. Brother Miqdad is helping us with some beautiful points to instill faith in our children. Brother Miqdad, you said growing in knowledge is very important. Children should be equipped with enough knowledge so that even if they face doubts, if they live in a society where they are facing non-Muslims, or they live in a world where they face questions, even through social media or some other platforms, so they should be equipped enough with the knowledge to answer these doubts, and so that which ultimately would strengthen their faith.
And so, as a family or within a within Islamic community, for example, we should never fear talking about taboo topics or challenging topics such as music, such as gender issues, such as drugs, all these things that children question or challenge that youth face, basically. We should discuss them, obviously, with their right approach, with the etiquettes that these topics demand. But children should feel, and youth should feel, that they are listened to and they are being equipped with the right answers to tackle these problems. And so when we do this, what happens is that not only just their knowledge is increasing, but their ability to understand and put things into perspective, put these vices, these wrong behaviors, these wrong ideologies into perspective, into how they see the world and how they see the purpose in their life. And so this really plays a big role in their faith, in keeping up their iman and their relationship with Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. So topics such as the ones I mentioned, topics that are related to today's challenging topics that youth are talking about, that are sometimes we feel that they question our religion, we should come up with answers for them. We should allow them to discuss it, hear them out, and then really strongly show the real answers from Islam, and that allows this increase of knowledge will allow them to then be able to feel comfortable being a Muslim, feel that they have enough skills, enough knowledge, enough awareness, and they are equipped to be able to tackle these challenges as well. And then they feel that we don't have a religion that doesn't have an answer. On the contrary, we have a religion that has a lot of answers for a lot of today's problems, and that if we really abide by what Islam says, then we are looking towards this true human growth and this true human perfection at an individual level as well as a social level.
Right. And that really would play an important role in the child upbringing. When they are equipped with the right knowledge at the right time, they would actually be equipped to face all the challenges and questions they are facing. And also, it's very important to teach our children that Islam is a complete way of life. It's not just teaching us about how to pray and how to give zakat and how to fast, but rather Islam answers all the ways of life, how to live, what to do, what not to do, how to behave. everything has answers in the religion of Islam. Thank you so much, Brother McDowd, for being with us. Thank you so much. Dear listeners, you were listening to IRIB English Radio. Until another session, wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Do you know what Islam is? It's a way of life for all. It is taught in the Quran for big and small. A way of life, a way of life, a way of life, a way of life. Islam is a way of life, a complete way.
A diverse range of programs. Spirituality. Youth. Eastern Tales. Roundtable discussions. Culture. Politics. All produced by IRIB English Radio.
This is A to Z. An introduction into Islamic lifestyle. Today's lesson, how to live an Islamic lifestyle so we won't have any regrets on the Day of Judgment. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. It is such an honor to be here at your service, dear friends. We are talking about how to live a Islamic lifestyle so that we don't have any regrets on the Day of Judgment. Of course, as we know, at one point or the other, sooner or later, and unfortunately we don't know, when and where we will die, but it is a certainty that we will all die, we will go to the grave, and then the Day of Resurrection will come, and we will be asked and told about our good deeds and our bad deeds and everything that we did in our life. So how do we avoid having an intense regret and sorrow on the Day of Judgment? So, of course, on the Day of Judgment, we find that one of the names of the Day of Judgment is known as Yawm al-Hasra, which means a day of regret, or a day of how I wish, you know, I could have done more, or I could have, you know, not done so many sins. And so on that day, when we are asked what we will do, one of the most intense griefs and sorrows that a person will have will be a person who gave up their hereafter for the world. So they sacrificed the hereafter and eternity and paradise in order for some worldly gain or benefit. This individual will be at the greatest loss, and so we have to live our Islamic lifestyle in order to prevent that from happening in the hereafter. We continue after the break. Welcome back, dear listeners. This is A to Z on IRIB English Radio. So we're talking about how to live an Islamic lifestyle so that we don't have any regret on the Day of Judgment and in the hereafter. So we had said how one of the people who will have the most intense grief and sorrow on the Day of Judgment is an individual who sacrifices their eternal life, their paradise, their hereafter, for some kind of material or worldly gain. Now, in some of the traditions, we find that a person even worse than that is one who sacrifices their hereafter for the worldly benefits of other people. So not only do they, you know, lose on their own worldly benefits, but matter of fact, they try to gain worldly benefits for others in exchange and sacrificing their own hereafter. So when living a Islamic lifestyle, we have to first and foremost remember that when there is a choice between the hereafter and the world, we have to choose the hereafter. When there is a choice between good and bad, we must choose good. When there is a choice between truth and falsehood, we have to choose truth. And when there is a choice between committing a sin or avoiding a sin, we must avoid a sin. And when there is a choice between doing a good deed and not doing a good deed, well, we must do a good deed. And so in this manner, and with these simple choices that we make, we will be choosing the hereafter, and we will be sacrificing some kind of a worldly, you know, gain that must be gained via the sacrifice of the hereafter. And so in this manner, inshallah, we can live a Islamic lifestyle so that we don't have any regrets on the Day of Judgment.
IRIB English Radio. Our website is parsetoday.ir.
You can email us at englishradio@irib.ir.
In the limelight.
Iran's membership in the BRICS group of emerging economies is a significant national, regional, and international development, which is important both to Tehran and BRICS members, including China and Russia. Regarding this issue, we have taken a look at world media websites and news agencies for further details. Stay tuned for the second part, please. Press TV noted, in recent years, there has been a lot of focus on Iran's membership in global political and economic organizations, institutions, and groups in order to spur economic growth and provide a ballast in the face of geopolitical and structural changes. BRICS has gained a special place in Iran's foreign policy due to its increasing importance in the international political economy and geopolitical developments. The Islamic Republic has good political relations with all five main members of the BRICS group, consisting of Brazil, Russia, India, China, and South Africa. Tehran is motivated by the international prestige, the geopolitical and geoeconomic linkage with the emerging world powers, and the regional and international status which joining BRICS can potentially bring in. New economic partners are about to come out of the woodwork after membership of BRICS, and access to new financial resources, technological findings, knowledge-based production methods in agriculture, food security, and trade could enable Iran to better deal with the hobbling impact of sanctions. BRICS is developing internal institutions for integration and increasing effective economic power in order to support development programs of its members and strengthen their regional and international position. The establishment of financial institutions independent from Western institutions can be considered the most important success of BRICS in promoting convergence and its most important advantage in the new global economic structure. Two financial institutions within BRICS are the pillars of the group's power, which also offer opportunities for Iran. The New Development Bank of BRICS is the most important economic pillar of BRICS, created with the aim of forging convergence among the members in the world economy. The bank was established in 2014 with the initial authorized capital of $100 billion to finance infrastructure projects in BRICS countries and other emerging markets. It is headquartered in Shanghai, China. According to the agreement, the bank shall support public or private projects through loans, guarantees, equity participation, and other financial instruments. Another key institution established with the aim of strengthening financial convergence among the members is the BRICS Contingent Reserve Arrangement, CRA. It is a framework for the provision of support through liquidity and precautionary instruments in response to actual or potential short-term balance of payments pressures. Although U.S. financial sanctions make it difficult for Iran to access the resources of these two institutions, BRICS has adopted various methods under its de-dollarization scheme to provide loans and services to members, which can reduce the impact of the sanctions. The New Development Bank uses methods such as providing loans in the national currency of BRICS powers, cryptocurrency and currency swaps. Bear in mind that Iran's integration into the BRICS economic framework is fraught with challenges as regards alignment with the economic policies, regulatory mechanisms, and commercial laws and regulations of the main and new members. Ensuring the coordination and syncing of the domestic bureaucracy with BRICS institutions in areas such as customs, tariffs, and investment regulations requires time and complex expert reviews. Nevertheless, the geoeconomic benefits of the membership are so many that any misgivings are roundly misplaced. As a full member, Iran would have closer economic relations with other member countries, which can gradually lead to increased business and investment opportunities. This cooperation can include various sectors, including energy, production, agriculture, and technology, and provide access to new markets and potential sources of foreign direct investment. Joining BRICS would also give Iran the opportunity to diversify its economic partners beyond the current circle. The BRICS countries have an overall population of more than 3 billion people, which potentially provides a vast consumer market for Iranian goods and services. This diversity would reduce Iran's dependence on a limited set of business partners and increase its economic resilience. Membership in BRICS also increases Iran's regional influence and geopolitical position. It enables the country to interact with emerging economies and have a say in shaping global economic and political affairs. In addition, Iran can actively participate in regional projects and contribute to the development of convergence in their region. By becoming a member of BRICS, Iran would access the financial resources of the BRICS Development Bank, NDB, and the Contingent Reserve Arrangement, CRA, to fund the development of infrastructure, energy projects, and other potential priority sectors. This can help to solve part of Iran's development needs and spare long-term economic growth, even though access to the resources of these institutions under sanctions would be difficult. Iran is a large producer of oil and gas, and its membership in BRICS can strengthen closer cooperation on energy security initiatives. BRICS countries, especially China and Russia, have significant energy needs. They can potentially cooperate with Iran on energy exploration, production, and infrastructure development. This cooperation would improve Iran's energy sector and provide ways to diversify exports. Meanwhile, BRICS countries stand out for their advances in technology and innovation in the developing world. Iran's membership in BRICS can facilitate the exchange of knowledge, carrying out joint research projects, and technology transfer, which could enable the country to increase its technological capabilities and competitiveness in different sectors. This can help Iran's economic modernization and reduce technological gaps with other countries. Iran is facing the most draconian U.S. sanctions, which has limited the country's access to global markets and financial systems. Joining BRICS can potentially give Iran more leverage in international negotiations and potentially reduce the effects of some sanctions. Moreover, the collective power and influence of the BRICS countries may provide a platform to defend Iran's economic interests and reduce trade restrictions. BRICS countries have forged increasing cooperation on agriculture and food security. Iran, with its diverse agricultural sector, can benefit from the best methods and joint initiatives through knowledge exchange with the aim of increasing agricultural productivity, production, and distribution of foodstuff. This cooperation can help Iran's food security goals and strengthen its agricultural sector. Finally, Iran's membership in BRICS can activate the Russia-Iran-India corridor, facilitating exchanges among the member countries and provide access to Eurasian resources along the Belt and Road Initiative stretching from China to Russia up to Central Asia and beyond.
Start.
Movement.
Speed.
Live in hope.
Toward the peak.
On Youth Station. Youth Station.
I am a Muslim.
I am a Muslim.
Islamidi.
Islamidi.
Allah my Lord.
Allah my Lord.
His word Quran.
His word Quran.
Muhammad Prophet.
Muhammad Prophet.
Praise be upon.
Praise be upon.
I am Muslim for all.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحیم. السلام علیکم dear listeners, brothers and sisters from all around the world. Home sweet home. We are back again at IRIB English Radio and this is Youth Station. And I am Bita at your service.
Yes, and I am Asma. Once more, I have the pleasure to be here. And now that I'm here with you and with Bita, I feel just wonderful.
Exactly, me too. So how are you doing these days?
I just right now, a second ago, I said I'm wonderful, but I'm stressful, I suppose.
Oh, my gosh.
Well, because we're waiting for the results of exams that we have done. And now the situation is just so scary.
It is.
Yeah.
Because I've experienced it last year. Mm-hmm. And when you're waiting for something, it's
awful.
Yeah.
You know, you'd rather get the truth instead of just hallucinating and just having some good dreams and you know what?
Actually, the truth that you told me reminded me of this sentence that honesty is the best policy.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Which I do not agree.
You know, I once used to believe in it so strongly. I still do believe in it.
Yeah.
But the thing is that the people around you would make you believe the reverse. There would come a day when you would say to yourself that maybe honesty is not the best policy.
But it doesn't mean that I'm telling you that you have to lie. Sometimes you shouldn't show other people the whole truth, you know? It's all about it. When you show the whole truth of something, you will be vulnerable.
Yeah, this is very true.
Yeah, and it's unavoidable, unfortunately, in the society. So you have to be wise rather than just you think like lying or something. No, because according to the hadith and narrations that I studied, all of them is like you shouldn't lie. It doesn't matter how hard the situation is. There are times, of course, in Islam that lying is possible. But these are the times that the benefit of lying is higher for all the people, not only you, than the harm that it has.
Exactly. You know, I was just thinking about something. Those people, just like you, who are doctors, some very difficult tasks to do. Like, imagine, you know that you're, well, recently I've been to a doctor who was actually an expert in blood.
Oh my gosh.
And then the people who were there, just, you know, you can see it from their faces. Some of them were so stressed out because they were waiting for a result, for the doctor to tell them what is the result of their, for example, checkup or whatever. And it was not an ordinary checkup, you know? And then there was a young man who got into the room, and then from his face, it was pretty much clear that he's suffering from a severe disease. And I was just thinking about the doctor. How is he going to just tell him the truth about his condition?
It's a really tough condition,
I
think.
It's very difficult. Sometimes you don't just wish to tell the truth.
It's not possible. You cannot hide it forever. For example, that person will, I don't know, live for 6 months. And you just, you cannot do anything about it, you know. And as a doctor, I think it can be a really tough situation to be put in. But especially about expertise that you mentioned, which is mostly actually handling cancer and so on.
Yeah.
And it's really difficult to tell the people that are going to die in 2 months, in 6 months.
Exactly.
Okay.
Yeah.
And, you know, you have to work in the way you're going to tell the people instead of just not telling them. Unfortunately, in our culture, it's like you're going to tell the relatives of that person, and the relatives are kind of acting like they're going to hide this from the patient, and it's an error.
So you say that if I know a truth about you...
It depends on the truth. But here...
If I say it to your mother, I'd be doing you something so horrible. But if I say it in your face, it's going to be better.
Exactly.
I would agree on that as well.
Because, you know, I don't like this kind of hiding thing.
I just told you, see, there's a problem. Don't hide it from me. Be honest and straightforward. Put it in my face. I don't have any problem with it, but I have a big problem with people who lie to me.
Yeah. So, sorry for my bitter honesty, but I think we have to go for a short break.
I knew it. I just knew that it would just pop up.
So, stay tuned, dear listeners.
This is IRIB English Radio. You're listening to Youth Station.
Rita and I were talking about, is it good to be always honest or not?
Yeah, which is a bit difficult, you know, to maintain
giving
it
a straight answer to this question is very difficult.
Actually, you know, there is something else, another point of view that I want to mention here. Sometimes, because of the modern world and these social medias and so on, people feel like more comfortable to be frank with each other. But sometimes I think this is not honesty. This is rudeness.
Exactly.
That we are, I don't know, doing it as being frank or something. It's just impoliteness. Nothing more, nothing less.
Thank you for mentioning that, because I do hate it. Some people think honesty means being cheeky. means being so rude.
Exactly.
And then they say everything into your face, and then they call it, well, I'm honest. Why do you hate honesty?
I hate this.
You're not
method.
Honest, you're cheeky.
You know, they're using this honesty as an excuse for themselves. And sometimes we have some good lawyers, you know, that use this honesty against you.
Exactly.
And the thing I'm going to tell you is that honesty is a tool. You know, the way you use it, your intention, and your situation, you know,
exactly.
they are all important factors that you have to keep in your mind.
Just speaking of honesty, it reminds me of a Persian poem, or let's just say a quote it is.
Yeah.
That says, you shouldn't say but the truth, and also not all the truth you have to say.
Yeah, exactly.
So this is very important. Not all the truth must be told, but on the other hand, you shouldn't say anything but the truth.
Yeah, I get it. You know, it is exactly the first thing that we mentioned at the beginning of the episode, that it's all about the whole truth. You
exactly.
know, you have to keep it. But it doesn't mean that you have to lie. Mm-hmm. Nope.
And also, you don't have to say it all the time. You know, sometimes there's some truth that you keep them for yourself, or you'd better keep them for yourself.
Exactly.
You don't have just to go every now and then and just claim them everywhere.
Yeah, I know. I think we've experienced these situations mm-hmm. with all that. We got stuck in some situations that we just didn't know how should we react to this accident or something. Should we lie? Should we tell the truth, the whole truth or whatever?
Should I hide it?
Yeah, exactly. I mostly choose silence. You know, this is
exactly.
a part of my personality.
Yeah, that's my strategy as well. But sometimes
it doesn't work.
Some very little times. Unfortunately, we just have to say the truth. Or, as you just said at the very first part of today's episode, that we can, as truth is the tool, we can use it in a way that is going to be good on both sides.
You know
the
what?
One who's saying it and the one who's hearing it.
Yeah, exactly. And another thing is that, unfortunately, lying is kind of unavoidable. There are many people claiming that they don't lie at all, but it was a kind of, I think, study or kind of people that they were claiming that they don't lie, and it was proved that even these people were lying at least 5 times a day. And, you know, you may sometimes think that you're not lying, but you are lying.
Well, unfortunately, as you just said, sometimes lying becomes an inevitable thing that happens into your daily sort of behaviors. So, those who say that we never lie are big fat liars, but also there are some people who try not to lie too much.
I think it's all about trying, you know. Mm-hmm. Everything you do, every step you take in your life is a way towards whatever you want to achieve.
Exactly.
You know? You cannot be all perfect, all innocent, because you're a human. I'm only human and that's self, you know.
Yeah. But then, just being a human does not excuse you from all the wrong things that you do. If you do a wrong thing by the intention that, okay, I'm prone to mistakes, then you're just lying to yourself.
But I think one thing which is more disastrous than all of this is that when lying will become your habit.
Oh, yeah.
Which, you know, sometimes you feel like you're addicted to lying.
Exactly.
Even in those situations that you don't need to lie, you lie.
That's horrible.
It is.
That's horrible. So let's break it right in here.
Exactly.
And
I wanted to mention
that.
Go for
a very short interval and then we'll be back. Yes, we were just talking about the times when lying becomes a part of you. It becomes your habit.
Yeah. And
which is so sad.
It is disastrous. Because, you know, I saw some people in my life that, you know, they just get used to lying. You cannot separate them from lying.
They don't have to lie, but they lie.
Exactly.
I have met of those people as well. Well, you know, Vital, just speaking of the story of lying and the saying the truth and, of course, being so honest, I just remembered a story from Imam Ali alayhi salam.
I'm all ear.
There was some people who said that, okay, there is a sin that's happening just across the corners. And then they sent Imam Ali to go there and to just be a proof. they thought that he'd come back and say yes. And then I saw that man doing that and that. What they had in their mind was that Imam Ali is going to go there and then come back with the proofs. But then the thing that happened, since he is so wise and so kind, he went there, but his eyes were closed. So when he came back, he just said, I saw nothing.
Nice.
So at the same time that he didn't say a lie, he wasn't so, prone to telling the truth.
Yeah.
He actually said the truth while the truth was something else.
I get it.
The truth to him was actually he has just closed his eyes in order not to see the truth.
There is a lot we have to learn from the wisdom of our Ayyamah.
Exactly.
And, I think... we cannot be perfect, I told
but
you the first part.
But sometimes through your wisdom,
yeah. You
can change the situation. Because sometimes not lying means bringing danger to some people's life.
Exactly.
Sometimes they ask me, okay, did you see that happening? Did you saw them doing that or this? If I say yes, then many people would get into trouble. So the thing I do is that simply I say, I did not see anything.
You know what? I think all of these scenes comes from this unfortunately tongue. You know, when you cannot keep your tongue, you will lie, you will backbite, you will do this, you will do that, you will say it, you will... And you have to keep it. And I think the first step that you have to take in order to be a better person is to control your tongue, the way you speak, and your manners.
Exactly.
And not lying is a part of it. And you have to be wise in this special concept, because there are times that you feel like lying is the only way out of your problem. But it's not like that. Sometimes you can somehow manipulate the truth. You can change the perspective in order not to lie and not to tell the truth.
Yeah, just as we
exactly.
I just brought to you that evidence from history, from the wisest man of all the time, Ali alayhi salam, and we have it in our Islamic heritage many times. Yes, it's true that you shouldn't say anything but the truth, but you are not forced to say the truth.
Exactly.
Sometimes you just add some extra information to people's knowledge, which are just redundant. But they would lead
have to
terrible.
Be really, really attentive, because it's a bit dangerous. And if you think that you don't have enough knowledge, you don't have enough wisdom in order to do that, you have to stop it.
Exactly.
And another thing is sometimes you can lie in some very specific situations that doesn't happen in our everyday life that we have in Islam, like when you are just trying to avoid an oppression.
Saving the life of a person.
Yeah, exactly. Saving the life of a person. These are the times and situations that, doesn't happen a lot. But so if they
these are very rare.
Exactly. Are there any situations that can we lie or not? And
Yeah, lying, well, there's nothing more important to God than human dignity and human life.
Exactly.
So in these two conditions, you can do everything to just save humanity.
Yeah. And at the end, I think our nature is kind of mixed with truth and the real truth, which we have to keep it in everyday life too.
Yeah.
I think it was all the time we had for today's episode,
exactly,
dear listeners.
Just like always, time flies so fast.
Unfortunately.
Well, I would say honesty is the best policy, but you just don't have to say it every time and any time.
And the whole truth.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You can keep something for your own self.
Yeah. It's a bit difficult. Mm. It's not as easy as she says, but you can do that.
Let truth be the prisoner of your mouth.
Nice. So we have to end our episode here.
Exactly.
And thank you for listening to us. I bid you farewell. Assalamu alaikum.
Wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
IRIB English Radio, a window to peace of mind and spirituality. You can tune in to IRIB English Radio 24 hours a day. We are with you. Are you with us? Are you with us? Are you with us? This is our voice from the heart of the Islamic Republic of Iran, IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight.
The Palestinian Islamic Resistance Movement Hamas has said it has enough Israeli captives to free all Palestinian prisoners in Israeli jails. We take a look at the world media's coverage of this story. Please stay with us. Al Jazeera television network has covered this story and tells us more. A senior Hamas leader has said that the group has captured enough Israeli soldiers during an unprecedented attack against Israel to make Israeli authorities free all Palestinian prisoners in Israeli jails. "We managed to kill and capture many Israeli soldiers. The fighting is still ongoing," Saleh Al-Aruri, the deputy chief of Hamas's political bureau, told Al Jazeera television network on Saturday, 7th of October. "Our detainees in Israeli prisons, their freedom is looming large. What we have in our hands will release all of our prisoners. The longer the fighting continues, the higher the number of prisoners will become," Saleh Al-Aruri added. Senior officers were among those which have been captured by Hamas, but Aruri did not provide any figures. According to the latest figures by Adamir, a prisoners' rights group NGO, nearly 5,200 Palestinians are in Israeli jails, including 33 Palestinian women, 170 minors and children, and more than 1,200 placed under administrative detention. The Israeli army has acknowledged soldiers and commanders have been killed and prisoners of war have been taken. It has not given any figures. The Palestinian Islamic Resistance Movement Hamas, the group running the besieged Gaza Strip, launched the biggest operation on Israel in years on Saturday, 7th of October, killing dozens of people and wounding hundreds after fighters crossed into Israel under the cover of a barrage of rockets fired from the Gaza Strip. Meanwhile, Hamas's social media accounts posted footage of what were said to be Israeli captives moved alive into the Gaza Strip. The surprise operation from Gaza came on the heels of the killing of four Palestinians in the occupied West Bank, widespread Israeli settler attacks on Palestinians, especially in Huwara near Nablus, and increased tensions at the Al-Aqsa Mosque compound in occupied eastern Al-Quds. Speaking to the Al Jazeera network, Saleh Al-Aruri said, "Hamas is engaged in a battle for freedom. This is not a hit-and-run operation. We started an all-out battle. We expect fighting to continue and the fighting front to expand. We have one prime target, our freedom and the freedom of our holy sites." Al-Aruri said Palestinians have a right to freedom, to fight the Israeli occupation and to safeguard their holy sites. "We will continue to fight until we are rewarded with victory, freedom and independence," he said. As observers noted that a land invasion by Israel could be imminent, Hamas said it is ready for the worst-case scenario. "All scenarios are now possible, and we are ready for an Israeli land invasion," Saleh Al-Aruri added. Al-Aruri also said that Israel had been planning to launch an attack on the Gaza Strip and the occupied West Bank. Earlier, Israel's extremist Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu said his country is at war, while Palestinian officials say ending the Israeli occupation of their territory is the only guarantee for security, stability and peace in the region. Iran's Press TV has also covered the same story and tells us more. The Palestinian Hamas resistance movement says the number of Israelis taken captive in the ongoing operation against the regime is far more than dozens that was claimed by Israel's Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu. Abu Obeidah, the spokesman for the Gaza Strip-based Hamas movement's military wing, the Zedin al-Qassam Brigades, provided the information in a recorded message aired shortly after midnight on Sunday. "Today, you talked about dozens of prisoners, and we reassure you, Netanyahu, that your prisoners are many times more than this number, and you must keep track of your soldiers well," he said. "These prisoners are present in all areas of Gaza, and everything that happens to our people in the Gaza Strip is happening to them," the Hamas spokesman added. The movement's fighters have captured a great number of Israeli forces and settlers since early Saturday, 7th of October, when they launched Operation Al-Aqsa Storm, the biggest to be carried out by Palestinian resistance groups against the Israeli occupying regime in years. Palestinians have launched their biggest operation against Israel in years in a surprise offensive that combined fighters crossing the fence into Israel, occupied cities with a heavy barrage of rockets from the Gaza Strip. It has featured heavy rocket barrages and surprise attacks by Palestinian resistance fighters against Israeli forces and settlers in the occupied territories. So far, around 300 Israelis have died as a result of the operation, and thousands of others have been injured, hundreds of them critically. Palestinian resistance leaders have described the operation as a decisive answer to the Israeli regime's unabated campaign of bloodshed and destruction against the Palestinians. The head of the political bureau of the Palestinian resistance movement Hamas, Ismail Haniyeh, says the resistance group is on the verge of a great victory following its surprise offensive against Israeli-occupied territories. Elsewhere in his remarks, the spokesman for Hamas's military wing, the Ezzedine al-Qassam Brigades, Abu Obeidah, says threatening Gaza is a losing game. Abu Obeidah also reacted to remarks by Benjamin Netanyahu in which he alleged that Israel is about to use all its force to destroy military capabilities of both Hamas and the Palestinian Islamic Jihad movement, emphasizing that Netanyahu's speech indicated a deep crisis for the Israeli entity. Abu Obeidah said, "Threatening Gaza is a losing game." Meanwhile, Iran's foreign minister says the ongoing operation launched by Palestinian resistance groups against Israel is an outcome of the Zionist regime's incessant crimes against the Palestinian people. The Iranian foreign minister, Hossein Amir Abdollahian, was speaking in a phone call with his Turkish counterpart, Foreign Minister Hakan Fidan, on Saturday, 7th of October. His remarks came after earlier in the day, Hamas resistance fighters broke out of the fences separating Gaza and the Palestinian territories and infiltrated a number of towns and settlements. A heavy barrage of more than 7,000 rockets was also fired from the Gaza Strip. The Palestinian Islamic Jihad movement said its fighters have joined the operation as Hamas called on Palestinians everywhere to fight and to resistance groups in Lebanon to join the fighting against Israel. According to Israeli media, at least 300 Israelis have been killed and nearly 1,500 injured following the large-scale surprise operation. The Iranian foreign minister, Hossein Amir Abdollahian, told his Turkish counterpart, Hakan Fidan, that the Palestinian resistance operation is a spontaneous move and the result of the Zionist regime's incessant crimes against Palestine. Amir Abdollahian urged all Muslim countries to remain united in support of the holy occupied city of Al-Quds, as well as the oppressed and resistant Palestinian nation. The two foreign ministers also discussed the latest situation in occupied Palestine, stressing the rights of the Palestinians must be respected. The Islamic Republic of Iran has declared its firm support for the Palestinians and their anti-Israeli operation, with the foreign ministry spokesman Nasser Kanani saying, "Operation Al-Aqsa Storm was a turning point and a new chapter in the continuing resistance of the Palestinians against the Zionist regime."
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم السلام عليكم ورحمة الله
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints
همه با وجود قده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم
All of us are opposed to the cancer's tumor, Israel.
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
In this program, we invite you to listen to the English translation of a part of a speech delivered by Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, the leader of the Islamic Revolution, in a meeting with the veterans from the Sacred Defense and the Resistance Field. This meeting was held in the Imam Khomeini Hosseiniya on September 20, 2023, inaugurating Sacred Defense Week. In the name of God, the Compassionate, the Merciful, all praise is due to God, Lord of the Worlds, and peace and greetings be upon our Master Muhammad and his pure, immaculate, chosen progeny, particularly the remnant of God on earth. I profoundly thank Almighty Allah for giving me the opportunity to attend this magnificent, comprehensive, meaningful meeting. I would like to extend my thanks to those who organize this event. Also, I would like to thank the brothers and sisters who presented various programs for an hour or so at the beginning of this meeting. The recitation of the Holy Quran was good. The anthems that were sung were excellent in terms of both the poetry and the music. The elegy was very good, and the speakers spoke about very good matters. Almost everything that is in our hearts and in our minds regarding the Sacred Defense and its leadership with the people were mentioned by these ladies and gentlemen. Nevertheless, there is a need to reflect on and to think about these matters in order to find solutions, God willing.
دنیای اسلام یک نسخه امروز دارد و اون اتحاد.
The world of Islam has one single prescription today, and that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united.
What I would like to say is that the event of the Sacred Defense is a prominent, important period in our country's history. We should understand this period and this important event properly and introduce it to future generations. I strongly believe that if our succeeding generations learn about the important, meaningful aspects of the Sacred Defense and realize how the Iranian nation was able to reach the heights of victory in this important event and to stand up there with power and pride, they will learn great lessons from it and they will achieve great things. This is my firm opinion. The greatness of this event must be recognized. Much has been done in this field. Books have been written, films have been made, and memoirs have been narrated. However, in my opinion, there is still much more room for work to be done. Up until now, we have not been able to recognize or make known the details of this great, colorful painting. We are looking at it from a distance, but if we look at it closely, we will find that in every piece of it there is so much beauty, so many fine points, and so much meaning and depth that one is amazed. Each piece of it is like this, and this information must be made known to people.
Allah, I wanna thank you. I wanna thank you for all the things that you've done for me through all my years. I've been lost. You guided me from all the ways that were wrong. Indeed, you gave me hope.
You
Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Rubashavit Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Saeed Pereza, London.
Rasha Saglam, Istanbul.
Saeed Amin Alemi, Kabul.
Shahanabad, Indian administered Kashmir.
Around the world with reporters.
Heads of governments were focusing on bringing more countries into the EU during a summit in Spain on Friday. However, millions of citizens across the current 27 member states are being neglected. A debate in the European Parliament has heard.
There are now 900,000 homeless people on any given night in Europe. And it's estimated that up to 125 million people in Europe live in energy poverty.
Apparently, social welfare systems in the EU are broken.
People across Europe are struggling to pay their rents, their mortgages, even the energy to heat their houses. Those losing their jobs are at a serious risk of becoming immediately homeless.
Sanctions against Russia are hurting the EU's economy. This as huge sums are spent on the war in Ukraine. Unlike EU decision makers, it seems a growing number of citizens want peace talks.
The solution is there. The solution is not to rearm Europe.
If France or Belgium had the war and Ukraine had this huge money, are we thinking that they're gonna give us this money? I don't believe so.
Meanwhile, the cash keeps flowing out of the EU and into Ukraine. Since things escalated in February last year, the EU has spent 83 billion euro on arming Ukraine, propping up the government in Kiev, and housing Ukrainian refugees. Some legislators claim it's a war the EU simply cannot afford or win. The European Central Bank has now increased interest rates 10 times in a row. The strategy, aimed at reducing inflation, is being questioned.
Inflation is the enemy of the poor and those on low incomes. But equally, high interest rates causes recessions, and recessions bring about unemployment.
Analysts point out that those driving the EU's economic and foreign policies are well able to afford the consequences, unlike the average person. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
In Paris, protesters gathered to express their support for Palestine's unprecedented and successful surprise military operation against Israel. By land, air, and sea, and with missiles, drones, and even manned hang gliders, the Palestinian resistance sent illegal settlers fleeing, captured Israeli soldiers, and apprehended Israeli military equipment, provoking awe in longtime pro-Palestinian activists.
We're all witnessing incredible actions by the Palestinian armed resistance, who, as far as we know, managed to come out of this huge concentration camp that Gaza is and inflict severe losses to the Israeli soldiers and settlers. We're looking at the news every minute.
The reasons for the offensive seem to be too many to count. This year has already seen a record annual number of West Bank children murdered, Israel wages 10 police raids every day, and Tel Aviv recently approved thousands of more illegal settlements, which one Palestinian official said was a declaration of open war against the Palestinian people. Last year, Israeli murders of West Bank Palestinians reached their highest level since 2005. While Israel's blockade of Gaza since 2007 is routinely labeled a crime against humanity. Israel's horrific crimes against Palestinians go back many, many decades, but so does the collaboration in these crimes by Western governments who often claim to defend human rights.
Today, we are, of course, going to congratulate the Palestinian resistance and to expose the complicity of our government, to start with the French government, who is never stop collaborating with Israel occupation and colonization, because nobody says it, but it's not two armies, one against the other. It's people that are occupied and people that are occupying.
More protests in support of Palestinians are expected, but in 2014, France infamously became the first